This is an I Am Listening podcast.
People who want to push this agenda to find the new Brexit, the new thing that we're going to do to solve all our problems, right? And they find these little things like this chicken nugget case, and then they seize on it and they say, this is the problem. If we could only sort out the thing that allowed this guy to stay, then we would solve all our problems. And that is the definition of populism. And that is a definition of easy answers that does not understand the problem that our country faces, but comes up with them because it has got one or two headlines that are based purely on misrepresenting the facts. And so we've got to get under the skin of these assertions around what human rights is responsible for.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us for another roundup of the month's comings and goings in Kent politics. I'm Simon Finley, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined as ever by Dan Essen, who covers the districts and boroughs.
Hello.
Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway.
Hello.
And also by our senior editor, Nikki White.
Hello.
After we talk for a bit, you'll also be hearing from a special guest interview with Tony Vaughan. He's the Labour MP for Folkestone and Hythe. But firstly, let's talk about what's been going on around the county. Robert, you pick up with some interesting stuff regarding guidance given to Medway Council staff about a beloved author who's very well-known in Kent.
Yes, so obviously we are in Dickens country, and the Guildhall Museum in Rochester has sort of an exhibit about Charles Dickens, and lots of, if you walk down Rochester High Street, there's loads of businesses that either sort of directly or indirectly reference Dickens in some way or another, because he, you know, various locations from a number of books are either inspired or set in Rochester. And basically Medway Council has, the Guildhall Museum has given advice to its staff about how to sort of around some of Dickens' sort of older views that we don't necessarily agree with today, and has sort of used phrases, has sort of want their staff to be able to distance themselves from these views that they say are sort of particularly upsetting to sort of modern audiences today.
Yeah. I mean, what sort of things? Just give me an example of what he's said to have done or written in the past which might have upset some sort of modern sensibility.
In this guidance, it says that sort of he mocks sort of foreign cultures, yeah, and practices and stuff like that. But there's a particular emphasis around the Indian Mutiny or Indian Rebellion, and it has different names, of 1857.
Which was probably quite recent and quite topical of the moment, but
yes,
perhaps doesn't weather very well.
Yeah, so he basically, it was this uprising within India, and around 6,000 British were killed, both including civilians. 800,000 approximately Indian citizens were killed as well in this. And it was a big news story at the time, and Dickens sort of called for there to be sort of major retributions against this. Now, we went out to speak to people around Rochester, including a local historian called Shane Waterman, who does sort of guided tours around Rochester and obviously talks about Dickens a lot. And he said that really we need to take this into consideration of the context, as you say. You know, it was very prescient at the time, but particularly for Dickens, and he sort of said specifically his son had gone over that year and was involved, his 16-year-old son was involved, you know, and was sort of directly facing the danger.
So what is this guidance? How are the Medway staff being advised to handle this?
Well, it's basically just sort of making clear that, you know, you should be ready to address if somebody brings this up. This is entirely internal guidance. It's not, you know, on the displays, or, you know, it's not,
no,
they've not changed anything like that. It's just basically telling people that there are these views and you need to sort of be able to address them and speak about them if necessary, and say, you know, look, this is who he was. These are some of the things he said and some of the things he believed. Another aspect is that he's sort of, the quote from the guidance was that he thought that the British Empire, you know, would successfully sort of make the rest of the world sort of white and middle class and within those sensibilities, which we don't necessarily see in the same way today.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So, but they're not being given training on how to respond and in, you know, what to say. It's just guidance and of something to be aware of.
Well, so this guidance has sort of been unearthed by the Telegraph, who's to obviously have particular views on this sort of thing. But as far as we can tell, it's just to sort of make people, the staff, prepared and conscious that this is something to consider in relation to Dickens. From the people that we spoke to in the street in Rochester, there was a mix of views of people saying sort of, well, you know, what do you expect? This is a man from, you know, the Victorian age. He's completely different from the way we live today. You know, there's things that from 50 years ago, let alone 150 years ago, that we wouldn't say today and that sort of thing. So we shouldn't judge him too harshly because he was a man of his time. Equally, he was quite progressive for his time. But other people are saying, well, you know, you've got to see our figures, warts and all, and recognise that, you know, they weren't perfect people.
Are there any statues of Dickens in Kent? Let's hope not.
Ooh, I'm not sure in Kent. There's definitely, there may be somewhere, but not in Rochester. There's no. But there's, as I say, there's loads of plaques for him. And he's...
Dickens seemed to have lived everywhere.
He does, doesn't he? Everybody seems to have a claim.
Strange enough, there was a... This isn't the first time Dickens' alleged views have been the subject of political controversy. In 2021, there was a now... I can't remember if he was on the council then, but he had been at one point a Labour and Green member of Thanet District Council, Ian Driver, and there's a building called Dickens House in Broadstairs where Dickens had a cottage at some point. I don't know how long he lived there. But during the sort of height of the Black Lives Matter movement, or at least its British incarnation, he went and using a marker pen, I had not spray paint or anything, more artistic than that, using a marker pen, he defaced the outside of this Tudor cottage, saying Dickens is a racist and all this kind of thing. He then admitted responsibility for it in court, but pled not guilty, saying his actions were justified, and he was in fact convicted of criminal damage. I think he was going for jury nullification, like the people who threw that statue into the lake in Bristol. But I wanted to ask Rob, I mean, you're a great reader, man of letters, dare I say, and you're probably more familiar with Dickens than most people who live in the area, which is so famous for your association. Do you care? Like, do you think it really matters that museum staff need to know the ins and outs of his views of the politics of the time and respond to it?
Well, I mean, it's a bit of a... I mean, obviously he held these views, you can't deny that, you know, and I think it would be wrong to say that this was something he didn't do. But on the other side, it's not a... I wouldn't say it's a huge part of who he was as a person. You know, there's a lot... These comments, particularly about the Indian Rebellion, Indian Mutiny, were from private letters and then sort of a public speech, I think, rather than, you know, they weren't huge aspects of his novels, which obviously is what he's most famous for. So if it's a bit of guidance, you know, this is internal guidance, and Medway Council said this is just to sort of assist in case this comes up. It's not, you know... They're not trying to cancel Dickens or anything like that.
It'd be a great headline if they were.
I mean, did anybody actually know any of this stuff before the Telegraph chose to tell the world?
In terms of the guidance? Ooh. No, this has only come out from their reporting. Yeah, so, yeah.
Okay. Dan, you've been covering some NHS troubles again, have you not?
Yes, as I'm wont to do. I haven't been to a board meeting of theirs for a long time because they're not often conducted in language I can understand. But East Kent Hospitals, it's the... biggest, one of the biggest hospital trusts in the country and certainly the biggest in the county. It runs, I think, five or six hospitals in total. And listeners may recognise this from last week because it was mentioned in the kind of summary, but I thought it worth discussing in a bit more detail. Essentially, they're running this scheme, which is, we got leaked an email, which said they're running this scheme, which is called a mutually agreed resignation scheme, which has the lovely acronym MARS. Mm-hmm. And basically what this is to cut staffing costs, they are asking staff... particularly ones in middle management positions, it seems, to come forward and apply to the trust for their role, to explore the possibility of their role being deleted from the workforce. So they say this isn't the same thing as a redundancy scheme and they're not obliged to accept anyone's application, which I suppose is true because redundancy implies direction. The short of it is they need to cut staff. They don't know who they need to cut. So they're asking members of staff to come forward and say, yeah, but actually, I reckon the trust could probably do without me. So I'd like you to, you know, there's got a pay system like with redundancy, you know, you get a payoff depending on how long you've served and that kind of thing.
If this is effectively a voluntary redundancy scheme where people can put their names forward, but it doesn't that leave the authority sort of, possibly sort of understaffed in key areas? Just because they put themselves forward doesn't necessarily mean to say that they're...
Yeah. It's not just that, like, if a nurse who's served 20 years, fancies getting a payout, they can come forward and get it. No, it's ones which they feel they can do without in the workforce, which presumably that must mean middle management, because there's the NHS is consistently, permanently understaffed in all levels of actual medical staffing. Mm-hmm. And people seem to know, you know, it's a big political topic. That it's middle and senior management where the NHS has loads and loads of people. But I think it's quite... I think it's stripping back all the kind of weird management ideology and language behind it is a really quite mental thing for a workplace to do, to openly say, we think we have too many staff, we think we could probably do without some of you, but we don't even know who you are, what you might be doing. So they're basically trusting in the goodwill of people who suspect that the NHS could do without them to come forward and offer to be deleted. What other workplace would do that, even in the public sector?
It's bizarre because it smacks of sort of rather weak management in some ways, because if you've got managers who can see where the problems lie, or, you know, potentially overstaffed, that they should be able to go in to sort of, you know, bring people in and sort of say, well, we're going to restructure the whole of this department, or, you know, this trust, and it's going to be done in this way in future. We're particularly going to look at such and such an area, possibly middle management. Are there any people who feel that, you know, and do it that way? But sometimes the you know, we've probably all worked in places where there have been redundancy schemes, and sometimes they're not voluntary.
Yeah. No, and they're not a pleasant thing to go through. Yeah. I mean, this could, I'm guessing as well, have a bit of a reverse effect, in that if somebody feels that they've done their stint with the NHS and, yeah, I'll put myself forward, and then they get told, no thanks, we think your job needs to be kept, so you're going to stick on, you might feel a bit disgruntled by that. And it's at a time when we really need to be G-ing up the NHS and making sure that people feel good about themselves, it might have a bit of an opposite effect. But
yeah, I don't imagine it would do well for staff morale if you're in one of these posts and you think, you know what, maybe I'm, because they've billed it as if you're looking for early retirement or a career change, you might want to explore it. If you're in some kind of managing some team which is being removed in one of these endless permanent NHS restructures or something, you might say, oh, maybe I could go, you know, retire 5 years early, get a payout or something, and then you ask for it and they're like, oh no, actually your job is actually just useful enough for us not to pay you off. It would really mess with the workplace atmosphere. And I mean, I'm informed that since my story on this went out, that they an email was sent to staff at East Kent Hospital saying, well, you may have seen reporting in the media, don't worry, we don't think any of you is superfluous. And after, this might be a bit too inside the sausage factory, but I think it's worth pointing out because it's ultimately very political, after the story went out, the NHS sent me a new comment attributed, rather than some faceless spokesperson, the acting chief executive, asking me to change the comment and add in a line saying, we don't think anyone is superfluous to the provision of services, which is obviously blatantly untrue, otherwise they wouldn't be running this scheme. It's such a weird case of political inertia, because there's the NHS obviously so middle and top heavy that there's nobody who quite has the political authority or direction to say, okay, we need to get rid of people. These are the kind of people we're getting rid of. And nobody can even openly say it, because these kind of people are
they're terrified of offending anybody.
Yeah, of course. They don't want to come forward and say, people with this kind of job, you're the ones we think we could do without. They're just hoping people will come to their own free will. It's very bizarre.
I think you've said that it's happened in other trusts in Kent. Do you know what sort of effect it's had there?
No. So we actually covered back at the late last year in December that Dartford and Gravesham NHS Trust and Medway Maritime NHS Trust were also running schemes of this nature. They tend to run for a short period of time. They open it for applications for around a month or two, and then they spend some time dealing with the applications, so on, because it's presumably quite a complicated management process, deciding, you know, what will we do without this position, that kind of thing. It's been suggested to me by campaigners and people who've served on the boards of hospital trusts that this is actually happening almost everywhere. But Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells NHS Trust back in December refused to tell us whether they were running one. And this time they saw fit to just ignore me when I asked. So I think it's probably safe to assume they are.
Nikki, trouble on beach, yeah?
Yeah, trouble on the beach. The sun is shining at last. And what do we want to do? We want to head to the beach. But yet again, if you found yourself in Broadstairs last weekend, it wasn't the peaceful, fun family day out you might have had planned, because a couple of TikTokers organised what they described as Broadstairs' biggest beach link up. Now, it sounds fun when you first hear that, but there were huge crowds of youngsters who headed to Viking Bay. And to be fair, most of them were probably just out for a good time. but big numbers can be intimidating, and things did take a turn for the worse. And some businesses ended up having to close early on Bank Holiday Monday after there were problems with shoplifting and antisocial behaviour. Now, the same thing happened last summer, and there will be an increasing number of people like me who now won't go anywhere near a seaside on a hot sunny day. It's just not worth it. You're either stuck in a traffic jam on the M2, or you're packed on a hot, sweaty train, or worse, you end up with the sort of scenes that Viking Bay witnessed on Monday. Now, East Kent MP Polly Billington, she is looking further ahead. She says more action is needed ahead of the summer holidays to make sure anyone visiting the area does so responsibly and respectfully. She's told us we need to ensure that all possible measures are in place so Thanet can deal with the strains of the summer season, from waste disposal to crime and antisocial behaviour. And I think that's what we need to think about as well. It's not just the impact of a huge number causing trouble on a beach. It's the things that are left behind afterwards. Now, youngsters heading to a beach in huge numbers and causing chaos is nothing new. Anyone who's seen Quadrophenia will recognise that. But it does seem like it's happening more often and in places that you might not expect it. So you've got city beaches such as Brighton, and more recently Southend, that had problems a few days ago where there was a huge gathering of people there. You might expect these kind of things in the bigger resorts, but Broadstairs? I mean, to me, it's always felt a bit more relaxed, a bit more laid back, rather than some sort of party capital for teenagers. Now, one of the people who was behind the get-together, he's a 19-year-old scaffolder. He says he was just simply enjoying a day out at the beach with his friends and it all blew up. The trouble had absolutely nothing to do with him. Now, that may be so, and he may be genuinely surprised, but he has 18,000 followers on social media, and he essentially invited all of them to go to the beach. And, you know, what did he think was going to happen? And this is a problem for people in authority such as Polly, the police, the local authorities. Social media has given everyone a public platform, and things like this can just be organised at the drop of a hat with very little notice, and it's seen by thousands of people. Now, I'm the last one to stop a party. I'll have a good time. But there's a time, a place, and, you know, edit your invite list. Don't invite 18,000 people if you don't want even half of them to turn up. Now, a few years ago, I was in Whitstable for a weekend and something similar happened. Thankfully, it was on a much smaller scale. But it's scary. You know, you're sat there reading your book, enjoying the swish of the waves. And then out of nowhere, a huge crowd rocks up and just causes havoc. It's frightening. I mean, we just packed up and went home. And Polly's right. With the summer holidays coming up, it's only going to get worse if something isn't done now. And it must be a worry for every MP who has got a beach on their patch.
I mean, what I appreciate why maybe people might not like the idea of many of your huge numbers of people not from the area coming in basically at the behest of some TikToker or whatever they call themselves. But what actually could the police and authorities do to say, like, you can't come and do something perfectly legal? Yeah, you can't come and chill on the beach for a day. Like, is the problem just one of scale?
They're saying it's the huge volumes. I mean, the police, I think all police leave had been cancelled because there were other events that had been planned in Margate. I think there was a big biking meetup as well. And, you know, bank holiday, beach, hot sunny weather, people heading to the coast, it's not that unusual. But I think The issue with this is that it is the sheer volumes of people turning up all at the same time, and things get out of hand. They do get out of hand. So, I mean, the police have got dispersal orders at their disposal, and I think we're going to see more and more of that in use. You're probably going to see more dispersal orders over several period of days throughout the whole summer, if not through the whole of the summer holidays. That's going to happen, but there's going to be a lot of people looking on social media to try and track down these last minute get-togethers.
So where are these people generally coming from? Is it London or everywhere?
Generally, I mean, one of these TikTokers was from Medway. Off the top of my head, I can't remember where the other one was from. I think. A lot of people are coming down from London because naturally they're not near the seaside. Easy access. I mean, you know, we've got a high speed train now that not only takes us up to London, which is convenient, but it brings people down the other way as well. And, you know, that's it's a great thing for tourism, but you can't tell me that these thousands of youngsters that headed down on the train brought a lot of money into the area. And, you know, were they buying ice creams at the local newsagents and the ice cream parlours? And were they... No, I don't think so. And it's the chaos that they leave behind. And it must be awful for the people that live and work there and who see all their hard-earned... And, you know, they've struggled through winters. They've struggled through a really horrible weather and look forward to this time when they can make their money and it's meant to be a nice place to be. But, you know, then something happens and you end up with what happened over the weekend.
We should return to a more traditional British seaside busyness of... Legions of Vespers and people wearing Doc Martens kicking each other's heads in.
I'm not quite sure we want that either, but, you know...
Makes for good films. So.
It does, but, you know, I think it's kind of like human nature for the people. You know, we are naturally islanders and I think we all just all want to head to the coast as soon as the sun hits, but it's not turning into a very pleasant place to be and I think we need to get things back in order.
Sorry. In other sort of heatwave adjacent news, Simon, you've been covering some more water politics at County Hall, right?
Well, funnily enough, I've actually been away for the last few days, but and missed the heatwave. But obviously, with it came either, you know, coincidentally or because of some fairly major disruptions to water supplies in places like Sevenoaks and Ashford and Maidstone and Charing and Whitstable, I mean, everywhere since. But this seems to have prompted a bit of political activity amongst the Green Party and the ruling executive at KCC. KCC have just literally dropped a press release out saying that they're going to create a strategic partnership to oversee the resilience of water across the county by producing public scrutiny and oversight across water supply, infrastructure and the quality of water in Kent. On the other hand, the Greens have decided that they want to get KCC to declare a Kent water supply emergency and invite South East Water and Southern Water to the Flood and Water Management Committee and also request the KCC's scrutiny committee investigate whether Kent's water supply is fit for purpose. Now, there's two elements of that. What can we actually declare a water supply emergency and what does that actually mean? But I suppose the question that they do put is whether Kent's water supply is fit for purpose. Now, given the amount of houses that we're going to build and going to continue building for the next 10 years, if not more, one does wonder whether South East Water, which is the big provider in the area, is actually able to do it.
I mean, firstly, would declaring... all the Kent councils declared a climate emergency in, I think, 2019. That doesn't seem to have radically altered things. Is there any political idea for what declaring an emergency would actually constitute?
That's, the detail is not in there. But I think what basically they're trying to do is I think from a political point of view, was trying to get ahead of the narrative. What the reform group at Kent County Council, led by Lynn Kemp-Curran, the leader of KCC, is trying to sort of... there may be a little bit of top trumps here. We'll come up with a strategic partnership. I mean, I don't quite know what that even...
Councillors love a strategic partnership.
Yeah.
It's almost as good as a hub.
Yes. But what will it actually be able to do? In practical terms, if Lyndon Kemp-Curran and the executive of KCC can actually get this together, which is not a bad idea, is not compel, but invite all the partners, the water companies, the regulators, the local councils, residence groups or whatever, into a place where they can sort of say, well, you know, what can we do and what can be done? And maybe in the longer term, you know, maybe the government has to listen and sort of say, well, you know, although it's a legally binding obligation of all water companies to do the things that they're meant to do, if someone wants to build 10,000 houses, they've got a legal responsibility to make sure that water is can be supplied to them. Now, where that water comes from is their problem, but that's an expectation that just is a given. But realistically, can this happen in the longer term? I think not.
I think not as well. I mean, it just seems that there isn't a day goes by where we're not seeing something flash up on our report saying, you know, there's a water main problem here or this pumping station is broken down there. And the infrastructure needs huge investment. and we're going to end up paying for it. We were chatting about this earlier on, weren't we? And I do wonder if we're going to get to a stage where our drinking, we will now rely very heavily on buying our drinking water from the supermarket and just using what comes out of our taps for bathing, showering, and you know, the everyday things such as that, and we will drink water from bottles because the supply out of the tap just simply isn't there.
And then when we had that major sort of crisis, well, it was sort of two or three crises in one over sort of November, December, and then into January, and we saw that, you know, the huge bottle stations, there were problems about getting the supplies from here to there, and it didn't seem as if South East Water was particularly well equipped to deal with it. But just goes to show that how fragile it is. It's almost as if, you know, if you continue to build houses at the rate that the government wants us to build houses, then this is without end.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we were reporting this week, South East Water said it pumped 660 million litres of water around the network on Wednesday, and that's 100 million more than a usual daily rate. And well, I think we've all got to play a part, how we can cut back on water, you know, using our water use. I don't know, maybe that we've just got to think, go back to basics and start again, really, about how we use our water. And
it's always gone beyond
sort of the infrastructure work.
Yeah, it's not just having a water butt and watching how much you use and how much you boil a kettle and how much you waste or whatever. It's if the supply's not there in the first place, you can't waste anything that's not there. No. And I fear that this, you know, the old burst water main being repaired and all the inconvenience that causes is going to seem like a rather halcyon time, the way things are going at the minute, given the scale of the disruption in the last couple of days.
Members of Parliament for the ruling Labour Party have been increasingly vocal in their criticism of the Prime Minister of late. But sometime before it was fashionable, some were already raising concerns, in particular around the government's attempts to change immigration law. We're joined now for the first time on the Kent Politics podcast by something of an expert on the issue, who also happens to be the Labour MP for Folkestone and Hythe, Tony Vaughan. Tony, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Daniel.
So, firstly, I wanted to ask, you were elected alongside many Labour MPs in the landslide victory in July 2024 under Keir Starmer's leadership. Yeah, the manifesto very explicitly promised change. How do you think the government has been delivering on that mandate since 2024?
Well, I think we've been delivering some change, and there's a lot that we have done that most people completely agree with. And frankly, there is no reason why half of it wasn't done already. So strengthening employment rights, strengthening the rules around the water industry, making a really massive disincentive for a water boss to not pollute because they might face criminal charges, renationalising the railways. There are so many things that we have done. Massive record spending in the NHS. I mean, that was the number one thing that came up on the doorstep, that the NHS wasn't working anymore. And we've got waiting lists right down to massively lower levels than they were before, because we're pumping the investment into the NHS that has been absolutely needed. And, you know, one just has to look at my social media, maybe have a look at my Facebook page, Tony Vaughan Labour, and my constituents will see that there is so much that Labour has done. Now, and often it is said that we don't communicate well enough what we've done. I think that is true, but there is a lot to communicate. You know, having said that, I did a lot of campaigning on the doorsteps over the local election period. We didn't have any local elections in Folkestone and Hythe, but I did a lot of knocking around Worthing, where they had local elections, in Rye, in Islington, in Hackney, in Haringey. And what I felt was quite often a sense that the scale of change that people want isn't actually happening quickly enough. And I completely agree with those sentiments. I completely agree that the public have to be ambitious about what they want from politicians. And, you know, there was a large sense that Labour wasn't changing stuff quickly enough. And I'm not going to criticise that perspective. And I think that that is where people are coming from. That is the reason behind Labour's record losses at the ballot box at these local elections a couple of weeks ago. And so, you know, we've got to think about that. Why are people so angry? And from what I'm hearing on the doorsteps, that it's quite often down to the basics not being there. So being in work, but struggling to pay your rent and to pay the weekly food shop and to pay your energy bills, not being able to, if a young person, not being able to move out of their parents' house because they can't afford the rent or they can't afford to buy a house. I mean, I have people coming to my constituency, Surges, who are homeless, who can't get any accommodation locally because the local authority doesn't have enough social housing to house them. You know, they get sent to places that are far away from where their family and friends, the children's schools, etc., are. And that is, that kind of base need, where you haven't got your most basic needs met. I mean, you know, we don't have to get too much into psychology to understand that that is going to result in a sense that you've got to reach for whatever answer a politician is offering you, if it's going to get you out of your current situation, which is, you know, totally unacceptable for so many people. And frankly, that speaks to the dire inheritance that we had. I mean, people often roll their eyes now when we stay 14 years, but it's a fact. I mean, you can't deny that the NHS was defunded, that our public services were stripped back, that we had austerity from the Conservatives for years and years, and then the Brexit shock and then COVID. The fact is that this government has been increasing public spending, not reducing public spending on our public services. And that fact is often missed. But I come back to the point that people aren't feeling the change that they want to feel, that they need to feel, to have a life where there is some hope, some sense that they can, live a little without it putting you into debt. And that isn't too much to ask. And so that's why I felt it necessary to say, look, we've made some great changes that we have to tell the public about. And I will always trumpet the things that we have done as a Labour government to make this country fairer and to make people better off. But I won't apologise for saying that we have to move much more ambitiously forward towards a policy programme that will really solve the underlying problems that are facing our society. And that's really behind, you know, that's sort of where I'm at with it.
So in 2020, when Keir Starmer was running to be the leader of the Labour Party, he was, it seemed to many, kind of promising to be a sort of electable radical, that he would deliver quite significant radical change. And obviously you said that you think the government has delivered on many good things, but needs to go further. Did you support Keir Starmer to become leader of the Labour Party in 2020 after the sort of wreckage of the 2019 election defeat?
Yes, I did.
I see.
Yeah,
and were you convinced by his pitch at the time, essentially, that you could have basically the kind of core tenets of quite a left-wing policy programme of public ownership and so on, but essentially just look more palatable to the public?
Well, I mean, that wasn't my rationale, but I mean, we were coming out of a situation where we had a leader who couldn't lead, and we had a situation where we had the party had many people in it whose values I didn't share. I mean, the whole I remember being involved in our local Labour Party and dealing with, you know, anti-Semitism allegations, which the party as a whole was just utterly unable to deal with, and it needed fundamental reform. And so I was behind that as a principle, but I was also behind having a leader who was capable of uniting the party, because the party was highly factionalized at that point. And arguably, you know, that has continued to a degree. But the key thing was that we could become a united party and be able to tell the public that we were capable of being government. And actually, that the historical problem that Labour has had is to convince the voters that we can be trusted on the economy. And Blair successfully did that, persuaded the public that we could be trusted on the economy, went into that 97 election, essentially promising to stick to Conservatives' spending plans to try and address that issue. And I think it was clear to me that we needed a leader who was able to think in a way that could get us into power, could think strategically. And obviously, given his whole background, that is somebody, he was obviously able, you know, to do that. But I mean, we got to the point in 2024 where the public just needed change. And what I've described from the sense on the doorsteps where people are kind of crying out and physically just struggling to make ends meet and make the basics work has got more acute as time has gone on. And so because change hasn't come immediately, I mean, you can order something on Amazon and get it the next day. We have a culture of expecting immediacy in everything. And I think it's hard to explain to people, just be patient, yeah, just wait, the change will come, don't worry about it, and we're working on it. I appreciate that is not an easy message to deliver or to receive, but we've got to a point where we really have to step it up, because we've done some good things in these 2 years, but we've got 3 years left, and if we don't rewire the problems in our system, we're just not going to have made the most of this opportunity. And it's likely that the public is still going to feel that what we did wasn't enough and that they need to reach for the more radical option of parties who are our opponents.
So one issue which is being dogs of the Labour Party ever since it came up, and it's being sort of tentatively discussed around possible changes to the Labour leadership and thus the Prime Minister in future, is the European Union. And obviously, Wes Streeting, possible candidate for leader, is much more open about thinking we should join the EU, rejoin it. Andy Burnham has sort of walked back from his previously stated support for rejoining the EU. Do you think Britain should rejoin the European Union?
I'm a very strong pro-European. I'm a member of the UK parliamentary delegation to the Council of Europe. So I sit in an assembly as part of my parliamentary duties of all of the countries, not just the European Union, but wider than that, to countries like Ukraine, who are on the sort of outer edges of Europe, but who are part of our European community. And, you know, Brexit was, for me, a big mistake, and I didn't support it. And I see constituents who are exporting businesses, small businesses, medium-sized businesses exporting to the European Union, who are saying we are just kind of massively overburdened by these new rules that result from having a border, a hard border. Mm. You're having to comply, because we're an external country, a third country, they have to comply with mountains of paperwork. They can't compete on a level playing field with other businesses, and they're hamstrung, and they're going, they're experiencing challenges that are not good for them. And those are businesses in Folkestone and Hyde. Those are businesses in Kent.
So is that a case for just straight up rejoining the European Union then, or do you think it needs to be?
So what I'm trying to explain is that there are businesses that are hurt by having a hard border, right? And that is, there is absolutely no purpose in doing that when we have our nearest neighbour next to us. Now, the way that we move forward is obviously the question. And what the government's been doing is to try to address some of the most acute and the most problematic types of friction. So there's been an agreement around the farming and food and what's called the SPS agreement, which is going to help on that stuff. And I think if we can show that we can build back these bridges in a way that benefit the British people, very, very clearly benefit the British people, it will be more clear to people that these sorts of cooperations are in our interests. And I think that sort of approach, where you're building trust step by step, so that we don't get back to these these debates of the past. I think it's very easy to sort of say, well, let's just rejoin. And as my instinct, as an ardent pro-European, is simply to say, yeah, let's just rejoin, brilliant. But you can't sort of take these positions in a vacuum. I mean, it's not just sitting around and doing what you fancy. You got to take decisions in this way that engage with the political reality that you face. And the front line of that political reality is that there is still a very, very large portion of the public, including the media, who are very, very pro-Brexit, despite the fact it has demonstrably harmed our country and our economy. And so I think the approach the government has taken so far, which is to say we're going to build back bridges in specific areas, is right. But I think that if we can kind of get proof of concept from that, we ought to be moving further in other areas and ultimately talk about some sort of arrangement like Switzerland or something like that, where you're essentially able to allow your economies to compete on a level playing field, but without taking that further step freedom of movement, which was for many people the red line. I would like that to come back ultimately, but I think we have to go step by step with the electorate on this question, because otherwise we're just going to get back into our corners of leave and remain, which was completely divisive for our country, and I would not want that to go back to that at all. We have to find a new way of proceeding on this issue that does not go back to those old divisions.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
So as you mentioned there, obviously a huge part of the vote to leave the European Union and arguably of all electoral behaviour in British politics for 15 years or more is immigration. It's now the central issue propelling the popularity of Reform UK as an insurgent party of the right. But before we talk policy, obviously I said in the intro you're pretty well acquainted with this field. Could you give us just a brief sense of your kind of professional background in relation to immigration?
Yeah, well, I was a barrister for 18 years before I came into Parliament, and I did lots of different areas of law. Much of it was in immigration. And so that would be helping people to come in, helping people to stay, dealing with issues of detention, children coming in and claiming asylum. And so a whole load of different situations. And actually, one of the things that sort of prompted me to consider politics was the Tories' Rwanda scheme, which essentially accepted that it could be in breach of constitutional fundamental human rights, but they were going with it anyway, which was just completely ridiculous to any person who believes in the rule of law and the constitution and human rights. I just sort of remembered drafting injunctions to get people out of detention or off planes. And I just thought, well, look, isn't it better to actually attack the policy here? And that's what that was part of the reason why I thought I would stand. Not the only reason, but that was one thing that sort of informed my thinking. This is one of the major issues of our day. And whatever one says about the solutions, the fact is that the public confidence in the immigration system is hanging by a thread. And government of whatever kind is going to have to win that back. Now, I think the central challenge when it comes to winning back public confidence in the immigration system is addressing the issue of small boats and to demonstrate that our asylum system can work properly. Because most people I speak to, even people who are considering voting for reform, will say things like, fine, if you're fleeing persecution, then that's fine, just come over. but why can't you claim before you come? Why do you have to come on a boat? And actually, that's a very reasonable question. You know, most people want to do the right thing. Most people do want Britain to offer sanctuary to people who are fleeing persecution. But what a lot of people feel is the fact that if our asylum system results in huge queues, in huge backlogs, in billions of pounds being spent on asylum hotels, for example, that isn't something that gives public confidence in the system. And so this government has brought initial asylum decisions down quite substantially. And so we are turning that around, that the number of small boat incoming boats has gone down by about a third, I think, compared to last year. So all these measures that are being taken are having an effect. I appreciate people will say, well, it's not having a fast enough effect. But, you know, this is addressing a long-term increase. And the measures that the government are taking with France to support their law enforcement along the border with Calais is good. I think what is missing here is a proper way of being able to claim asylum before you come, because to have a safe way and a lawful way of claiming asylum is a missing piece here. And I think we've really got to address that, because it doesn't make sense to me, and it doesn't make sense to people from actually right across the political spectrum, that we are still in a situation where our system almost requires you, if you want to claim asylum, to get in that boat. And that isn't sustainable, I think, in the long term. But in the short term, we are doing the work to address this sort of incoming small boats thing, which you know, I think people have to accept is part of what is driving a sense of lack of control. But fundamentally, it's about these backlogs. It's about the system not processing efficiently enough. And as I say, the government's done a good job in getting down initial incoming numbers. It's doing a good job in addressing the initial decisions. What it needs to now do now is to resource the appeal stage better, because we've got, I think, a very large number of appeals which haven't been dealt with, which is where the government needs to sort that out. And that will be by making sure the courts are resourced properly, that making sure that there are enough people, both administrative and judicial, to decide these cases, because that's where the main blockage now is.
Obviously, law is quite central to this question. You know, it's why the parties of the right, which want to reduce immigration, say we need to leave the European Convention on Human Rights. But you mentioned that the solution is essentially administrative. You know, we need to make decisions faster and more effectively. But what I think, sort of steelmanning the argument that many voters would make, is that, you know, these are not just administrative, judicial, legal questions about who can and cannot stay here. Who in the state does not and does not have obligations to. It's a fundamentally political question, and ultimately is up to the citizens of a country to decide who they want their state to have obligations to. And what many people on the right point out is that every government elected since 2010 has promised to reduce immigration. Every government has failed to deliver it, basically.
Well, that's right, is it? I mean, the net migration figures now have come down to about 200,000, which is two-thirds less than it was at the point we came into government. I mean, this is what I find utterly hilarious about people like Reform, where, you know, after Farage promised Brexit in order to get immigration down, it shot up because he forgot that actually it would result in us having to get workers from abroad, or because the Tories took decisions about immigration that had that effect as well. And so, you know, and now he's promising to withdraw from the convention because that would solve all our problems. It's utter nonsense.
I mean, is it not the case that the convention is the ground on which a huge proportion of asylum, anti-deportation, that kind of thing, those cases are fought and won? And many people say, you know, stuff like foreign criminals, people being convicted of crimes being allowed to stay in the country, people overstaying perfectly legal visas and then claiming asylum, people lying about their sexuality or political activity to say to oppress another country. If the law allows those things, many people would say surely the law should be changed.
Okay, look, let's just go back to basics here. So the people who are peddling this idea that we need to withdraw from the convention because it would solve all our problems are peddling exactly the same falsehood that they peddled with Brexit. It's complete and utter nonsense. Now, net migration under the Labour government has come down from around 900,000 to 200,000. Right? So that is a fact. So the point in your introduction that the immigration has simply gone up government by government is absolutely incorrect. That the net migration figures out today confirm that net migration has gone down to around 200,000, which is the levels that we saw before Brexit, and the numbers of people leaving the country has increased. And so it's not necessarily a place that people want to come anymore. And then that raises issues about, well, who's going to look after our elderly in care homes? Who are going to do the jobs which we're finding it difficult to staff? Who's going to work in our supermarkets? All this sort of stuff. Who's going to build the houses that we need for our young people and for our families and for our communities? You know, these questions are not answered by the people who are coming up with these sort of points about the convention. And that is because they know full well that the European Convention is not the reason behind any problems that are perceived with the immigration system. And what you'll see in this, you mentioned foreign criminals. I mean, what we'll see there is very, very tiny numbers of cases where a foreign offender defeats deportation for human rights reasons. Very, very small numbers of cases. And I should just underline that in terms of the European Court of Human Rights, that the over 90% of the overwhelming majority of cases, immigration cases that go there, are rejected. So I think even the ministers seem to accept this when you press them about this. And so it's not the European Convention is not the problem here. It's the scapegoat. And these examples of people who couldn't be deported for specific reasons, and we've heard one of the cases involving supposedly an Albanian who couldn't be sent back because his child wouldn't eat chicken nuggets. They're utterly ridiculous, complete misreading of what happened. The judge specifically said in that case that was not a basis for the finding, which I think was overturned anyway in the appeal court. So what happens is people who want to push this agenda to find the new Brexit, the new thing that we're going to do to solve all our problems, right? And they find these little things like this chicken nugget case, and then they seize on it and they say, this is the problem. If we could only sort out the thing that allowed this guy to stay, then we would solve all our problems. And that is the definition of populism. And that is a definition of easy answers that does not understand the problem that our country faces, but comes up with them because it has got one or two headlines that are based purely on misrepresenting the facts. And so we've got to get rid. We've got to get under the skin of these assertions around what human rights is responsible for. Because actually, what human rights are responsible for is a whole load of positive things in our society. People will come to me about all sorts of things in their lives that they need to be sorted out. Take an example of care homes. There was an important case in the European Court of Human Rights that allowed somebody living in a care home to have their wife living with them, and they were otherwise separated. There are so many examples: civil liberties, the rights to protest, to free speech. All of these things are what every mature democracy have. It's called a constitution.
But they were mostly won by the domestic labour and trade union movements in every country which is part of the European Court of Human Rights. The right to universal suffrage and free speech and protest was won, not through international courts.
We'd have had a load of people working in factories, having their hands cut off, working in awful conditions. And the reason why we turned that around was because the Labour Party was able to create a movement to get into Parliament, representatives of people on the ground who were affected by the everyday realities of that essentially totally unregulated capitalism, and got to a point where we have rights. Now, all around the world, in France, in Germany, in every country of the world that is essentially a democracy, power is limited by rights. That's just a fact. And what I never understand about people like Farage and the Tories who want to tear all that stuff up is that they never have an answer as to what they would replace it with, because they will always need to accept that we have to have limited government by virtue of having a constitution set of rights that holds back the executive. So they never say what they'll replace it with. And that's because ultimately they accept that we need constitutional democracy, but they're just creating a load of nonsense, the new Brexit, the new easy answer that will solve all of our problems, that is just simply, you know, based on sand.
Mm. So I suppose I should give the opportunity. A lot of the argument about this is predicated on yeah, the basis of particularly international human rights law. And what many people who are more sort of radically critical of immigration and the international legal settlement would say, you know, from first principles, why does the British state and thus the British voter have any obligations to anyone who's not a citizen of Britain? Surely that is what nation statehood means, is that a state is responsible for a particular place and a particular people. And if it starts having responsibilities to, you know, everyone, it essentially has responsibilities to no one. What is the first principles case for why the British public have obligations to take in refugees, for example?
Okay, so it's a nation state can decide to do what it likes, for sure. That's a statement of the obvious. Most people, right? Not everyone, but most people are proud of our history and our tradition of supporting those in need. So most people I speak to think that it was a good idea that we let in refugees from Ukraine after their country was invaded by Russia. But most people think that is a good idea. Not everyone, but most people. Most people think it was a good idea that we took in those Afghan interpreters who interpreted for our armed forces in Afghanistan. And then when the government changed, they had to find protection. Like, most people accept that as a principle. Now, the reason why that international obligation exists is because Britain signed the Refugee Convention in 1951, because it agreed that after the horrors of the Second World War, we need to treat where there are people fleeing persecution for a political reason or similar reasons, that we should give them refuge. And that is a basic moral human principle. And if we were invaded by a foreign power and people needed to flee to France or whatever, we would want that too. That's the purpose here. That's the moral principle that you would want to enact. Now, that is becoming, people like Farage are setting up this conflict where they're sort of saying, we have to choose between doing that and looking after our own. Now, that is the most ridiculous, false choice that there is. That is not a choice that the question of the Refugee Convention raises. Because we can decide how to process refugees. We can, if we have a system that can say you're genuine and you're not, which is what we have, and that system can just do its job, work out the people that have got a good claim and those who have an unmeritorious claim. We can have that system where we look after refugees that we've decided to look after. And reject others. That's what the system does. You have to have a line in any system of entitlements. But that is not taking away from the obligations we have towards our own citizens. They're two completely different things. They don't require that. It's not as if you can only have one but not the other. So you know, states will decide what they want. But if we get to a situation where we think we have to get rid of these obligations that we have voluntarily ourselves entered into, we're just going to join countries like Russia or Belarus, who aren't members of this community of nations, these European values, these values that people in Ukraine are fighting for against a despotic regime in that of Vladimir Putin. And what is partly driving them is their commitment to the European Convention and the values that hold us together as a European community of nations. When I go to Strasbourg and I for the UK delegation of the Council of Europe, I speak to many Ukrainian MPs, and they say this to me constantly. you have to keep reminding your country, which is being listening far too much to people like Nigel Farage, that we are fighting this despotic regime in Russia because we want our freedom. We want human rights. We want all the things that Russia doesn't believe in. And so to undermine that and to step away from that community of nations would just be, it would be against everything I believe in. It would certainly be against everything that I would say the vast, vast majority of British people believe in. Because we can have an asylum system that works. We can have a system that allows people to meet the basics and indeed have a good life, not just a basic life of subsistence, but actually a life that is, allows people to be whoever they want to be and to thrive. And we do that by funding our public services properly, by properly regulating and having, where necessary, public ownership of things like water, which are not working for my constituents at the moment, by making sure that our NHS works. You can get a doctor appointment when you need it or don't have to wait years for an operation. All of those things are at risk under those governments that reform and the Tories are offering. I mean, Nigel Farage really wants an insurance-based system for the NHS. He doesn't want the NHS to be funded by general taxation. This is a man who has somebody in his party who's convicted of taking money from the Russians for asking questions in the European Parliament.
He has been expelled from the party now.
Of course he has. But you know, let's just get real about this. What is behind Reform UK? It's people who are not acting in the British interests. They're pushing an agenda which is contrary to the British interest. And I think people need to wake up and really think, what is this guy offering? Is it just saying what we want to hear? Is it basically offering an easy answer? And who is paying for it? I mean, where is this 5 million? Why didn't he declare this 5 million pounds? What's he got to hide? Why doesn't he come to the House of Commons to deal with the scrutiny that arises from that? It's the actions of a party which is simply not ready to govern and certainly is not in a position to convince anybody, I think, of what the answers that British people really need.
Last question on immigration before we move on to something slightly different. Is there also an electoral imperative here that the kind of left bloc of British politics, the Labour Party, Greens, Lib Dems, Plaid Cymru, and SNP, your voters are at least full-throated sort of activists in particular, are much more likely to be quite supportive of immigration. Do you think the Labour Party is at risk of kind of alienating what remains of its core vote through the kind of harsh rhetoric on immigration which Keir Starmer has sought to pursue?
Well, I mean, there's polling out today which suggests that most Labour voters or Labour considerers, people who aren't necessarily, committed Labour voters, but people who consider voting Labour, don't support, for example, making a care worker wait 15 years for settlement while a banker only needs to wait for three. And I think that says something about why those particular proposals should not be taken forward. And they are only proposals. They were in a consultation paper to which the government hasn't yet published its response. But certainly I think some of the announcements that we heard in November around the rhetoric, particularly around some of these reforms, it is not speaking to Labour inclined voters. I constantly say what I think about that, and I like to think the government will listen, but I think what we saw at the local elections was a consequence of taking a position on issues like immigration, which is not just communicating a policy badly, but it's sort of actively targeting the very people that our country needs to do jobs that we need. I've talked about care workers. I've talked about people who work in supermarkets, but there's a whole range of areas. I mean, construction, there's a 200,000 worker shortage. If we essentially alienate the people who we need for our economy and our country, to move forward, that's not going to help the country. It's not going to help our communities. And really, it's not what we need as a party either. And so I think we're going to have to really think carefully about how we move forward. It is, I fully accept there is a debate within the party about this sort of stuff. And I'll continue to raise my voice. But I think ultimately, you know, in whatever seat we're talking about, we're not just see sort of in a London places, but, you know, areas, most in most areas, there are people who think that this sort of approach, you know, the end settlement proposals, for example, are not necessarily where we need to be going. And with the current electoral system, if we lose a little bit, there are small margins between the different parties in each of the areas. If there is if we don't get this right, I think we're going to continue to go downhill electorally.
And related to that is, in short, everything's pretty bad for the Labour Party at the moment. The Labour Party has suffered a precipitous decline in membership in the past 7 or so years, to the point that the National Executive Committee doesn't even officially publish membership figures anymore. If you combine voter turnout and the amount of people non-registered, the 2024 landslide election win was done on the vote of about 1 in 5 eligible voting adults in this country. Is there a case that the Labour Party is pretty much down and out and just held in stasis by the electoral system?
As I said, after the local elections, we need to change our approach. We need to be much more ambitious. We need to be much more radical. We need to rise to the challenge posed by the voters, which is to change people's everyday experience for the better. You know, all of you have talked about rent and jobs and futures, everything. And we've got to do that. And that is the challenge. And if we don't, we may well be into the wilderness. And so we have to respond. I don't think that the King's speech that we had the other week contains everything that we should be aspiring to. I think we need to go further. I think we need to talk about things like public ownership models in the water industry, for example. I've got 2 beaches in my constituency that have no swim advisory warnings. That is a signal that the current system for water regulation and for running the water industry is not working. And so that is one way, if we talk about public ownership, public involvement in ownership, it could be a way that we address that. But it's those sorts of measures that essentially are slightly more radical than where we are at the moment, to try and achieve more radical change more quickly, is what we need to do. And that's the challenge. And I think we've just got to get onto it and rise to it.
Tony Vaughan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Darren.
Right, that was an interesting discussion you had, Dan, with Tony Vaughan. I used to work down in that area, and it was for many, many years a seat held by Michael Howard. And he was then succeeded by a guy called Damien Collins. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Damien's majority at the 2019 election, the great Brexit general election, was somewhere around, 20,000.
It was very considerable, yeah.
Yeah, and that's been completely overturned. Tony Vaughan has taken that. He's a Labour politician, and that was never thought of being even slightly possible. Do you think he's going to be a one-term wonder?
I think probably, I'm sorry to say. It's really interesting to speak to him. I've been trying to speak to him to get him on for a while. He's a very vocal critic of the government. Interestingly, he told me he supported Keir Starmer becoming leader of the Labour Party in 2021. He was originally sort of that wing of the party. His background is an immigration lawyer. That's his area of expertise. And obviously, we discussed that quite a lot. And I think he essentially, I respect the fact he must really, really believe what he says, because I don't think it's particularly politically popular. I tried to ask him for a sort of political case for, why it is Britain has obligations to refugees and asylum seekers, high immigration, all that kind of thing. And I didn't perhaps unsurprisingly for a lawyer, I found his answers to be a bit legalistic. And, you know, frankly, you know, Folkestone had voted for Brexit. It voted for Conservatives very consistently. Reform got quite a good showing. His majority is only 3,700 as of 2024. Mm. If the trend we currently see of immigration being the kind of driving issue of all voting behaviour and Reform being the party which capitalised on that continues, I would think it would be quite a push for him to keep a seat, especially given that he, with his very publicly and clearly set his views on immigration, but it's all pretty good grist for the mill for an anti-immigration party to capitalise on in that seat.
Yeah, well, Reform are predicted to win it.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. And, you know, demographically, the seat is very, very similar to Dover, maybe a little bit more gentrified now than it used to be. But, I'm sure he really, really believe what he says, because I don't think it would stand in a great political stead. Ditto with relation to the European Union. When I asked him about that earlier, his answer sort of seemed to me to be that we should actually rejoining the European Union would be politically poisonous, but we should do everything we can to kind of simulate membership, which the technicalities of dynamic alignment or whatever may not be a big vote winner, but if people can spin it as pro-EU MP, pro-immigration MP versus anti-immigration, anti-EU challenger, I think most people in Folkestone would probably vote for the challenger.
Mm. What did you make of him, sort of on a personal level?
Well, I like him. He's very friendly. He, I really want to talk about immigration because that's his area of expertise. And he makes his case quite well. And that's obviously stood him in quite good stead through his legal career. And it's interesting to speak to somebody who has a more technical knowledge of the specifics of immigration law and how these big controversial cases, criminals being kept in the country and defeating deportation, all those kinds of things. Somebody who actually has firsthand experience of what goes into that rather than just sort of reading it through the news. But similarly, I didn't find his answers on it entirely convincing. He was happy to dismiss those as a very small number of cases, which of course they are in the grand scheme of immigration. The number of say, foreign nationals who commit crimes and then defeat a deportation case on human rights grounds is quite small, but they are important and they really, really, really offend the common sense of quite a lot of voters. And a lot of those are the kinds of voters who live in his seat.
And that's it from us at the Kent Politics Podcast. You can tune in again next week for our regular weekly bite-sized episode. You can keep up to date with the latest politics news on our dedicated webpage at Kent Online. And you can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter at kentonline.co.uk/newsletters, which drops every week with a roundup of news, views, and a few quiz questions too. And don't forget to tune in to KMTV's Politics Show every Friday at 5 p.m. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.